And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Happy day that ends in Y.
If you're listening on drop day, it's a Tuesday, so hey.
Happy Tuesday or any other day of the week.
I had a meeting with my boss today, and he was like, I'm trying to figure out something to say for every day of the week. So today is Terrific Tuesday. I was like, all right, man, this is a lot of energy for a Tuesday, but sure. And he's like, I'm just trying to think of something for Thursday. And I was like, well, I call it Friday Junior. And he was like, great, I can work with that. I was like, all right, there you go, man.
Oh, man. Ugh. I need that kind of energy in my life.
Yeah, it's good.
I dig that for him.
It's good for when like work stuff where you're like, all right, well, let's get pumped over an alliteration. I'm down.
Because
otherwise it's just work.
And you do 40 hours of it and then you go home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But then life happens outside of it, which is great.
I love that part.
Yeah.
Like this. Really we get nice. To do this.
And this is cool. This is fun. This is an exciting case before we have something big coming your way.
But that's all we'll say. So there.
So don't even try it.
Don't even try to guess what we're working on, okay?
No, because like we're not going to tell you.
But you probably could guess it, but we're not going to tell you.
Exactly.
Like you probably know, but don't even try.
Yeah.
Ugh. Like it wouldn't even be that hard to figure out. But no, like,
it'd be like taking candy from a baby and it's like.
Ugh. And that would be rude.
So rude.
So don't even, if you wanted to guess, you could do it. But don't expect us to tell you.
Yeah, you'll find out next week with everybody else, okay? You included.
Yeah. So jot that down.
But outside of all of that preparation, I don't know, summer's just been summering.
Summer's been summering. It has flown by. Like we said before, like there has not been a weekend,
no.
I think, this entire summer that I have not been slam packed, like busy, awesome, really fun stuff looking forward to. But I think I'll rest in November, maybe January.
Yeah, I'll rest with my depression nap in January.
Yeah, we are getting to the point here in New England where like it used to be light out longer and now it is slowly getting darker a little bit earlier. Slowly, like it isn't, you know, it's not like daylight savings time yet. We're like,
it's
that is a harsh change. But it is kind of starting, like, as we're recording right now, it is really not light out anymore. But a month ago, it would still be much lighter. So just kind of that change where I'm like, oh, no, it's starting.
Oh, no. And then also I'm, like, furiously sending, like, fall things to people because I'm like,
it's coming.
I took a walk the other day and the air was a little bit crisp.
Yes.
It was a little bit crisp.
Like,
and
a Diet
saw a
Coke.
Red leaf. Yep. Fresh.
I did see some leaves changing.
Yep.
Which here in New England, as you know, because we talk about it every fall, is like our favorite part about living here, and it's the best. And so when we start to see it.
Oh, it gets me going. The little skeleton in my body gets a going. It's happy.
We love fall. We love doing all the cute fall things.
Yeah.
I actually just booked a weekend away. For my husband and I for our 1 year anniversary.
Aww.
And so we're going to have like a little fall fun festival.
Wait, you guys.
Things.
Comment, let us know here on Instagram. Have you been here since the wedding? Because you guys have been here the whole time.
Oh, so. My. Yeah. Have you been here when I was like having stress dreams about the wedding? And then since then, I've been having stress dreams about the wedding. You remember that?
I do. Oh my gosh, and Taylor Swift's getting married now. And thank God you got married first because otherwise, like, your nightmare could have come true. She could have actually taken your venue.
She could have bought the venue and decided that was her wedding day.
She said, Travis and I are getting married here on your wedding anniversary.
She's like, I always wanted to come to New England.
Although, I think she's a girl's girl. I think if you were like, girl, what? She'd be like, fine.
I don't know about that.
I think
that.
She would have built her own. She's got the money for it.
She's going to have like a Swift palace and she's going to get married there.
Ugh. But I don't know. Other than that, it's just been like beach days. It's been relaxing. I went to the ocean last weekend with my very first ever day off this month and maybe since last month too. And the waves from Hurricane Erin, insane. Like there was no low tide. It just simply didn't exist.
Yeah, all the way up the East Coast has kind of gotten slammed, and especially like the northeastern part of the U.S. like has just gotten some pretty significant, like crazy high waves, like high tide that they've never seen before. So really interesting the way that that all played out.
Really cool. I saw some surfers doing some things. I heard some surfer bro talk. They were like trying to find some like high waves, man. They're doing okay here, but they've pretty much died down. So we're going to drive up the coast to see what else we can find. And that was an actual conversation, but it was cool to see because
I do believe that.
Yeah, I'm not coordinated enough for surfing. I am hoping one day I could be. It's always been something I want to do. But I
do not have the coordination for that or the balance.
I don't have the abs or the coordination, but those are two things I'd really like to get at some point. I'm not holding my breath, but I am hopeful.
We've been watching Animal Kingdom, and it's like, again, it's like, think crime family, but like surfer crime family. And almost every episode has some aspect of surfing in it, even if it's just for like 2 minutes. And every time I watch it, I'm like, I don't know how they do that. I don't think I can do that. Could I do that? Would I try that?
I'd try it. Could I do it?
I feel like the kind of surfing I'm more likely to try is the kind on a cruise ship where they have that like pool with the flowing water and you try to just stand as long as you can and there's a guy holding your hand so you can get your balance. That's that's more my speed. But like if everybody turned around and closed their eyes so that they weren't watching me, then it'd be over for you bitches.
Over. And I came to the compromise that I will try paddleboarding. Because until I have the coordination for surfing, you're not getting me in the ocean doing that.
I do think paddleboarding is a good compromise.
Yeah. And like I've been, I don't know, I've always liked it. But I read a book called Malibu Rising earlier this year that was very surfer themed. And ever since then, I've just been like, I want to try it. I could do it. No, I can. I could try.
We can try it.
That's just been like, that's the inner monologue. Just I'm like, I want to. Could I? No, but maybe.
I feel like it's one of those things that even if you totally mess it up, you can just kind of have fun trying.
So something maybe a little less intense than the ocean on hurricane waves to start.
For sure. Yeah.
That's smart. But until then, I'll keep reading. I hit 20 books recently.
Insane.
It's never been done for me. I don't think I even did this in school. Sorry, all the teachers that I definitely said I did do it in school.
That's a rite of passage. You always say you did it when you didn't.
Yeah. But this has been exciting. It's like the furthest I've ever gotten.
Hell yeah.
And
you still have like 3 months left.
I know.
Actually, 4 months left. And really.
I'm going to be done with the 21st book real soon because a good friend of the pod, Emily, we went to visit her parents kind of recently and her mom has like a little free library and there was a Junie B. Jones book in there. And I was like, the B stands for Beatrice, but I don't like Beatrice. I just like B, that's all. I have to check this out.
I used to have like a complete set. It came in like a pack of like 6 or 7.
Yep.
And I remember reading like 3 in one day.
Yes.
And this is so weird. I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but I was like one of those kids that like felt really safe and really happy when I like packed a bag or like packed a basket or anything. So I had this little basket and I would have my little stuffed animals and I'd have their like little blankets and little things for them. And so like I would pack it all up and I'd pack my little books and I'd bring it to different spots of the house and I would sit on the floor and I'd read my books and then I would go sit somewhere else and I don't know. So weird.
I love it. Oh, baby, but like, Allie.
I like. There's something about me. I love packing for a trip.
Yep.
But something else about me is I hate unpacking after a trip. But the serotonin I feel for just like everything has its little spot and everything's all folded and you got everything you need and like you know it's all right there. What is that? What mental illness is that?
I don't think. I think that's just being organized. I think that's just the joy of organization.
But everything else in my house is not, or at least anything I touch, he is very organized and like very particular.
Well, that's because you're living.
But I know like my mess and I'm like, I know where that is in that pile.
Yeah,
for sure.
Your piles.
Yeah, I know where that is. I know where that is.
I have the important pile. I have the semi-important pile. I have the non-important pile. I have the pile of things that I need to go through and put in other piles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have the piles. Even though very clean, just disorganized.
Yeah, I'm clean. I'm just a little messy.
Yeah. But Do you want to get into it today? Because I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I want to hear that. And I want to read Junie B. Jones. And I want to hear this case.
Right?
Probably equally at this point.
That's actually super fair. You can have you. The book when I'm done.
But not a second sooner, damn it.
So jot that down. So, yoo-hoo, pod's on. We're getting into it.
Hey.
Hi, hello, howdy. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Aww.
Today, we are talking about a fascinating case. But before we hop all the way into it, I wanted to do something I do every now and then. And I want to talk about something seemingly very random. So today, I'm going to talk about, drumroll please, in-laws.
Oh.
Yeah,
I know. Not where I thought we were going.
I know, I know. It's kind of a touchy subject. You love them, you hate them, but even if you pick your partner, you don't pick their family. And even though they very much become part of your family, I've been thinking a lot about the families we're born into and those we pick. And there's a lot of motivational speakers and cliches and those who talk about chosen family and the friends we make along the way. And I'm not saying anything bad about that. Like, I fully believe in that. But
you better. You're my chosen family.
Right?
Or get out.
Get out. Well, I can't. You're stuck with me. So
yeah, it's a for life thing.
So I'm going to be here.
Abby got a life sentence.
Good luck evicting me.
Womp womp.
What court would kick me out? They'd say, ma'am, that's for lifey.
That's squatter's rights.
But everyone, even the people in your chosen family, have family that they didn't pick. And that's a real roulette people play when it comes, especially when it comes to the parents of your partner. In the best of cases, you get in-laws that become second or sometimes even third sets of parents. Caregivers who love you and want the best for you and help you grow and make you feel at home. And in the worst of cases, mother-in-laws show up in white at your wedding and cry when they hear that their son's proposed.
I can't imagine that.
Oh, you should get on the Reddit wedding shaming. Whew, it's a lot of it.
I see, I'm lucky because I really do like my in-laws and they love me and I love them. And my husband with my parents, like, they have a great relationship. So I know that I'm very blessed to have that. But like the thought of marrying into a family where my in-laws, especially my mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Like if she hated me or just like hated the fact that her son was happy. Like, what is wrong with you? How are those families function or they don't?
I think there's a particular brand of, I honestly don't know what it is, but there's like a specific boy mom who's showing up in white to the wedding. And I think it's very interesting. And I would like to do some tests and study them like little ants in a little ant house.
Is that at that point not on the groom to be like, mom, you need to leave if you can't respect my wife? Is that not on that day? That woman gets one day, and that's her day.
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, you won the roulette.
You guys, let us know. I need to know. Do you think that the husband should ask his mom to leave or change?
From every wedding I've been a part of, and I've been lucky enough to be a part of a handful at this point, usually the mother of the groom, the mother of the bride, they're so excited about it that they're like sharing photos beforehand. So I would hope that that's not a surprise.
Yeah.
However, I can't imagine someone saying they were upset about it and then it's still happening and it being something that was like agreed upon. But anyway. Anyway, all that to say.
Wild.
It's a wild faux pas. But
yeah. Hey, just don't do that.
Don't do it.
If you were thinking about doing that, don't.
Don't. And if you have in-laws that you don't get along with, I'm sorry to say, and I'm happy to say, today we're talking about the kind of in-laws that so many people want to have. And we're getting back to our roots and taking it back to New England.
Okay.
Specifically, today we're going to talk about Vermont in the 1980s or like late 1980s. Mm-hmm. And as per the usual, just from the top, I wanted to take a minute to just cite some sources and trigger warnings. Today, I used information from ABC7, CBS News, Cairo 7, The Boston Globe, and Unsolved Vermont. I also used an episode from True Crime New England on the case, which was super helpful for some like local insight on it, mm-hmm. which was cool. And for trigger warnings, we do have murder. There is a small mention of sexual assault and also a suicide note. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, they're both very brief mentions, but they do come up. And mostly it's just agonizing wait times and absolute dumb fuckery, which at least for me is usually a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the words of a wise woman, I don't suffer fools well. So onwards, I wanted to set the scene today. Zooming in to small town Danby, Vermont in 1989. Vermont is a state that I've personally always described as the state I would be if I could be any state.
Yeah.
It's kind of granola, down to earth. It's like what I think of when I think of quintessential New England. People who are kind and familiar without being like performatively nice.
That's just the Midwest trauma in you.
It is. And also I love maple, but not the point.
But it matters.
But it matters. So New England, despite being around in American history since the very beginning and one of the last settled places for the indigenous tribes that migrated down from like the Alaska, Canada areas after the Ice Age. Don't ask. I got really into like history documentaries for a minute recently. It has had a pretty low crime rate, all things considered. Taking away Boston as like a major metropolis, and honestly, probably even with Boston included, the crime rate just really isn't that high here.
Let's keep it that way.
Right. And sure, there are old houses in various states of repair from the 1800s to now, but the reason people left New England after arriving was the harsh, cold winters and a difficult landscape that was difficult to navigate. We have mountains, an ocean. I mean, New Hampshire is literally right there, and it's 98% rock.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally the Granite State, because that's all there is. So it's historic. It's rich in culture and has long-term residents, but it's not particularly dense in population. In Vermont, most of the population settles between like the middle bottom third of the state, just above the Green Mountain National Forest, and up in the northwest side by Burlington. Danby, in relation, is tucked away in a little nook just above the Green Mountain National Forest in like the lower middle section of the state. In 2020, the population was just over 1,200 people.
Jeez.
Which, mind you, is less people than there were in my high school growing up, which was one of multiple high schools in my specific town.
Mm.
So it's a very little place.
Yes.
Everyone knows everyone, and it's exactly the kind of small town vibes I get from Gilmore Girls, except like a little less hoity-toity, you know?
Mm.
While in the 60s and 70s, Vermont got the reputation that many still think it has today about being kind of like a hippie haven and a center for like communal cultural living. By the 1980s, going into the 1990s, crime rates were rising. This seems to be attributed to like a new trend of younger people in the area and a general trend of people leaving like generational family agriculture careers. And just statistically speaking, crime tends to be higher for people in these groups. Like when there are younger people, there tends to be higher rates of crime versus like mostly a retired population kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just kind of average for what we would expect to see. And they've been declining ever since. But at the time, it was definitely rising for Vermont. But even with this in mind, Vermont still had and continues to have less than like a third of the nation's crime rate. So it's still almost nothing.
Right.
And in fact, safety is one of the highest virtues among the residents there, with something like 70%+ of residents believing that generally other Vermont residents can be trusted, according to a study in 2008.
Didn't know that.
It's a big part of their culture. I think it was like that with like maintaining a healthy ecosystem, like air and water. And there was something else there. Oh, having good, like sustainable jobs for people. I was like, this is a nice set of virtues you guys got there. I like it. Good goals. But Danby, from what I can tell, is like peak small town, quintessential Vermont. And this is where George and Catherine Peacock decided to call home. In 1989, George was 76 and Catherine 73, both born in the early to late 1910s.
Oh, geez.
George and Catherine were pretty stereotypical members of that generation, which is called like the greatest generation, a name I am sure they did not pick themselves. Having lived through the Great Depression and World War II and being born in the literal middle of or immediate aftermath of World War I, people in this generation are like overall considered to have like really good strong work ethic and being really resilient and really resourceful. These two emulated these virtues so much. And also, I think we're like pretty much everybody's grandparents in a lot of ways. The two had three daughters that at this time were grown and raised and all living outside of the nest.
Mm-hmm.
But George and Catherine were hardworking. They were resilient and resourceful. And anyone in their generation seems to have these qualities. I don't know about you guys, but in the New England True Crime podcast or True Crime New England case that I listened to this, they were just talking about like how their grandfather or grandparents like would retire and then 2 weeks later like pick up a part-time job somewhere because they just can't sit still.
Oh, yeah.
This is them to a T. They're like,
I can confirm.
Yes, they're in the neighborhood. They're not sitting still. They are in their 70s and they're like, I got to go to my job 3 times a week because I can't sit still. I'm going to make some bread for a little thing. I'm, you know, they're,
oh, yeah.
They're in it. And despite both of them being in their early to mid 70s, I guess, they were super active. They were deeply routined, incredibly punctual, and known as both generous and kind. This couple made their home in Danby go far beyond the walls of their physical house. Even their property had like a little small gift shop on it where they would sell like little books and knickknacks. That's, and like,
precious.
Catherine would make baked goods that they'd sell there.
Mm.
It's adorable. They are like literally my dream future. That's all I want.
Like, that will be you.
And George, who was said to be punctual to the point that you could set your clock to him, had a routine where he would.
Yeah, that's not you.
Yeah, that is not me. Ooh, I'd bake the little bread.
Yep.
I don't know time. It's not real. It doesn't exist.
Haven't met her.
George knows time.
George knows time.
George knows time. Good. And every day he'd go to like this little convenience shop or like local, I don't know, maybe kiosk corner store kind of thing, mm-hmm, where he'd pick up a daily Rutland Herald newspaper in the morning. And on the 3 days that he went to work, he'd go to his part-time job at the Rutland Travel Lodge that he worked at to stay busy.
Oh, okay.
And likely due to the small population of Danby, but also raising 3 children and sounding just in general fucking adorable.
Yeah.
Everybody knew George and Catherine.
Can I just say there's something really sweet about this generation of people, because I really do think they are the greatest generation. And,
yes,
you know, the age they were during World War II and what they did and when they came home and just all of that. But there's this funny thing I've seen online and it really rings true. And it's like, it's about like, you know, you have this really like old gentleman and his granddaughter is like, that's my pop-pop, my yeah, pawpaw, my pee-pee. And it was just like, imagine you were a World War II fighter pilot and fast forward 50 years and someone just calls you pee-pee pop-pop.
Yep, they're like, this is my gam-gam. Yeah. And you're like, girl, I played professional Major League Baseball while the men were away.
He's like, that's my gup-gup. That's my gup-gup and my mimi.
Yeah.
Just anyway, wild.
I love it. This is them. You know what I mean? And they're just like doing their little thing.
Yeah,
they
got
their
pawpaw
routines. They got their little gift shop. They're like in and around, putzing around town. George is like, if you're on time, you're late. And if you're early, you're on time. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's adorable. And they are Mimi and Pop-Pop to someone, you know? Mm-hmm. But the neighbors knew them, even if they weren't like super in depth. You know what I mean? I think this is any small town. You know everybody enough to know their name. You probably know them enough to know they had 3 daughters. Maybe one of them went to school with your daughter, or like they had a mutual friend somewhere in the middle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But George and Catherine, like many New Englanders I've found, were still generally private. Like, they were happy to have a community and they were super kind. They were known as generous and they went to a church that they attended in their community and they were pretty religious, but like by no means into mischief. They weren't bad people. They didn't have to like share every waking thought with everyone.
They weren't bothering anybody.
No, and they just had like a pretty decent surface level relationship with anyone that weren't their people, and that's fine.
Perfectly appropriate. That's what I'd expect.
But this is why it was notably concerning on Sunday, September 17th, 1989, that George was not only not on time for his shift at the travel lodge, but he didn't show at all.
Okay, so that doesn't sound good.
And for a man who was both regimented and dedicated to showing up for work and appointments, which he just said you just don't miss, this already had alarm bells going off for his community and coworkers. One coworker who worked the front desk at the Travel Lodge was so concerned she made a phone call to a friend of the Peacocks who was out of town but was staying in town for like a portion of time. Her name was Lorraine.
Okay.
And Lorraine said she also hadn't heard from George or Catherine, but she was actually going to go by their house later that day to make sure they were okay, because she was a little worried too.
That's really sweet to have people that check on their community, though.
Yeah.
People don't do that anymore.
Not the same. And when she got there, their car was in the driveway and the house was locked up. And this was usual for George and Catherine. Like, they were super security conscious, even though it's a really safe place to be and people felt pretty safe here. They just weren't fucking around with it. My words, not theirs.
I'd rather be overprepared than underprepared.
And that's them too. So like, yeah, the door was locked, but nobody's freaking out because the door is locked. They're like, yeah, it's George and Catherine. Like, of course it is. Now, the weird part was that the car was home, but the doors were fine. And Lorraine obviously couldn't get in. It's not like she had a spare key or anything. So Lorraine is like, all right, well, I got to figure out something to do because their car's here. They've got to be here somewhere. Something's got to be going on. They're not answering the phone because people have tried that already. So she goes across the road, like the literal highway. I mean, highway. It's literally a road. But she goes across the road to the neighbors, Jay and Faith. And Jay and Faith have lived across the road from George and Catherine's red home and noted that they were getting concerned, too, because George's fastidious routine of newspaper collecting, regardless of his workday, and Catherine's routines of updating the little shop made it particularly worrisome when Jay realized he hadn't seen either of them in a few days. The last he could remember was George mowing the lawn 4 days before.
Still mowing his lawn, though. Good for him.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Oh, he's doing the thing. But the three go over to the home together, knocking, of course, but getting the same quiet response. They wanted to make sure their friend and neighbors were okay, but struggled to find a solution. Being 1989, they couldn't text or use Find My Friends to see if they were inside. And they could have called, but they have already done that. And likely, one person would have to go back to a landline while someone else stayed there to see if they could hear it ring, to see if somebody picked it up and shut it off or whatever.
Very true.
And even then, what would that prove? They already weren't answering the phone, just like the door. So that wasn't really an option. And peering in through the window by the door was the next best thing. So Jay was being a little snoopy, as was in his right. But he saw something concerning. He thought he saw George laying down by the bottom of the staircase. And he got panicked, thinking that maybe he fell down the stairs and hurt himself. And again, the door's locked, so Jay's trying to find a way in. And he's using some quick thinking skills. He knew the doors were always locked, but they didn't tend to lock their car doors. And the car door had a garage opener on the visor. So he opened the garage and it turns out that door was luckily unlocked. So he was able to get in that way.
Uh-oh, I don't think that's a good thing for him though.
It was a bit of a rough shock because upon arrival into the home, Jay was met with a horrible scene. George didn't fall down the stairs, but had seemingly been attacked and violently struggled from the top of the stairs all the way down, before being stabbed, where he succumbed to his wounds. His wallet was ajar just outside of his pants pocket, and Jay found George dead. After calling the police and response coming quickly, they also found Catherine in a spare bedroom upstairs who had also been stabbed in the chest.
So they're both dead?
Yeah. Notably, and just interesting, she did have several wounds to the chest, but none of the clothes that she was wearing were punctured.
Oh, right.
Which is just odd. I don't believe they found any evidence of sexual assault. It's just worth knowing, like, that it's just weird to me.
So she was, like, covered after she was killed, basically?
That, or somehow, like...
Maybe when she was getting out of the shower, she was attacked, and then they dressed her?
That, or they came in from behind, maybe while she was putting a sweater on over her t-shirt or something, but...
Okay.
Just really odd to me, especially when there's no evidence of sexual assault for that to be the case.
Yeah.
So, interesting, but... I will say, at this point, I have heard conflicting information if Catherine had been just barely hanging on and was pronounced dead just before arrival to the hospital, or if she'd already been found deceased. I believe she was found deceased just from some of the paperwork that I've seen from the appellate court.
Yeah.
But regardless, neither Catherine nor George survived this brutal attack. And first responders also found some extra evidence at the scene. There was a bloody boot print in the home, and they also found, obviously, George's wallet was next to him and had been, like, rifled through, but it was generally undisturbed. And the same was true for Catherine's purse and wallet. It had been, like, gone through, but it didn't really look like anything was missing. Further, analysts suggested that the kind of stabbing meant the attacker must have had some blood transferred onto them. And that happens a lot of the time, but especially when there's, like, more than one stab wound. Like, I don't want to be too graphic, but it is messy. Like, it's going to get on them.
Yep.
So they're thinking there has to be some evidence of this somewhere outside of the home. But other than that, the scene couldn't tell them that much. All they could see was that there was no forced entry into a home that was pretty locked down. And so they moved on to interviews.
Sounds like somebody they knew.
That was definitely the town's perception. And I think in this investigation, there are a few things to note. The first is that it was cold for a very long time. Like a very long time. So some of this information we have now is great and helpful, but perhaps not the entirety of what was able to be collected over the years, just due to, like, investigators keeping information close to their chest as they worked. But also because it was 1989, and who knows how well everything was documented and where in the world anyone is at with digitalizing records like that.
Right. Yeah.
I just am not sure that we have everything in this investigation. We do have, I think, the important bits, but my gut instinct tells me there's more.
Trust your gut.
The second is that this is also the world in which there's only 1989 technology. DNA was around and it was becoming useful, but it was nowhere near what we had today. This is like early age DNA testing. So they're still in, like, this can tell you if it's O positive.
Yeah. We might know if it's a man or a woman.
Right. Like, maybe. Yeah. At this point. So it seems that the investigators took to interviewing family members first, which makes sense. This seems like it was because they probably had the best insight on George and Catherine's community and acquaintances to see if anybody wished them harm. But also, we know the stats and it's usually someone you know. And also, there was no forced entry, so someone had to know how to get in or have access. But also because local rumors had spread that George and Catherine had a lot of money in their home stashed away and that a family member probably broke in to steal it. This, along with the initial disturbance of the wallets at the home and just general crime trends being, like, mostly robberies in the area, and they were actually rising in the area, kind of led everybody to think it was a robbery gone wrong. That maybe someone thought two older people who might not have the same defense and get more to gain from robbing would be an easy target.
You work your whole life for somebody to be greedy, break into your home, kill you, and take it all from you? That is just, that's disgusting.
Right. And then they think that somehow that's the plan and it got messed up, which led to the stabbings. Now, a personal note. Stabbing seems mighty intimate as a gone wrong measure. Mm-hmm. Not impossible, but that takes effort, that takes force, and that takes close range. So that has to be pretty intentional. It's not just like, get off of me, I want to get away from you.
Right.
But also, when the rumor mill picked up that it could have been a family member, the investigation obviously had clear next steps. It seems like out of the three daughters, we know at least one was interviewed. Her name was Penny, and her niece was also interviewed.
Okay.
I don't think this would have been like a biological grandchild, though. I think this was like on her husband's side.
Oh, okay. Got you.
This is part of why I say I don't think we have all the information, because I would assume that all of the children would be interviewed. We only have information from Penny.
Yeah, unless they lived in a different country or something.
Right, but I don't think that was the case. I think they all lived maybe like a state or two away, but I don't even think like cross country. So I would think they'd at least have phone interviews, but we just don't have access to all of it. I digress. It's around this time as well that investigators stop considering this to be a random robbery. For one, random is kind of funny because, well, it's not random usually, and there's no forced entry. So it's not like they just picked them out of the street and said, we're going to go there. Because there has to be some level of acquaintanceship with them or a ruse to get them inside.
I mean, the only other possibility I could think of is how the neighbor got in the first place, which was knowing to go to the car.
Right.
Push the garage door opener, gain access that way, and hope that they don't hear the door going up and that the door is unlocked on the inner door.
Right. Which is like a few ifs, but not necessarily impossible if they were stalked or something. But investigators kind of quickly ruled out the robbery trend as a whole because nothing was taken. Yeah, George's wallet was next to him and Catherine's wallet and purse were gone through, but nothing seemed to be gone. No jewelry was taken. No valuables were disturbed. And despite the rumors that the couple had a lot of money in there, I don't know if that was true or not, but the children did like a walkthrough, or family members did a walkthrough with the investigators and didn't see anything disturbed. So if it was under like one particular floorboard, nobody noticed it was missing.
So it sounds like they almost set it up to look like this was a robbery, but it was not.
Right. I think that's what I'm getting from it.
Yeah.
But also, just interesting, if they did have a lot of money in there, all I can think about is like Mary Poppins and all the banks shutting down and like them being like, we can't trust the banks. We can't trust the banks. Like, put it in the floor. Not the point, but whatever local rumors of cash stuffed, there was no evidence to suggest it even existed, much less that it existed and was taken. Plus, all of this together just, it kind of threw them off. They were like, we don't think that's what it is, but like, there's no other reason anybody wants them harm. Like, they don't have any enemies. They don't even have like a neighborly quarrel with someone down the street about how ugly their lamppost is and how it's an eyesore and they have nothing else to do but complain about it. Like, they don't even have that.
Yeah, they keep to themselves. They have their little hobbies, their little business. Yeah. They're keeping themselves going. They're staying active. I don't know. Isn't that what we all hope for someday?
Right. With someone that you love and like a good family that you raised that's doing well. Like,
yeah, you did your job. Your kids are out there living their lives and I don't know.
Bake that banana bread. You know, like that's.
Yeah. Those are the rocking chair years. I'm looking forward to that. Like, I'm excited for kids, but I got to tell you, I'm like equally excited for grandkids. I really hope that's in my future because that right. I. To spoil the children of the people I love the most, who now have made people that I now also love the most, and then when they get fussy, give them back to their parents? Are you kidding me? That sounds perfect.
Hey, babe, it's vomiting. Here you go.
Like, oh, he's having a tantrum. All right, off to mom. Bye.
Yep.
Perfect.
So it just kind of left everybody stumped. And they're interviewing people and they interview Penny. And when they do that, they learn that she lives in Liverpool, New York with her husband, Michael Louise. Penny and Michael lived together and reportedly hadn't seen her parents in about a month. Penny noted she didn't know officially where Michael was that day, but she had her own alibi that checked out.
Okay.
Investigators moved on to ask Michael some questions, who said a few interesting things. Michael worked diligently at a car rental company in the airport. It was either like Hertz or Enterprise, but that's the vibe, you know? He seemed to be quite the handyman, and he really lucked out with his in-laws. Now, reports vary here, but he either left particle boards at their home or they were willing to give him some particle boards they had laying around, which I looked up on Home Depot as of today are anywhere between like $20 and $40. So it doesn't seem like they're super expensive, but definitely helpful for like building things, you know?
Something.
And personally, I'd venture to say it was probably the latter. They were probably willing to give him some that they had lying around, just knowing like their nature and how generous they were said to be. But despite initially saying he would never drive to Vermont, all right, he did eventually tell law enforcement that, okay, he was going to go to Vermont that day, but you see, he's just like he's a regular guy, you know? He left in his Chevrolet Celebrity around like 9:30 to see if he could go pick those up. But of course, he's a regular guy. So he drove all morning and he started to feel tired and he stopped at a rest stop in Saratoga, New York around like 2 p.m. Deciding ultimately that he'd never be able to finish this drive because he was so tired. So he turned around and he arrived home between 5:30 and 6.
I don't believe him.
Well, if this doesn't make sense to you, it shouldn't. Because it didn't make sense to the investigators either, who were wondering why it took Michael 4.5 hours to drive a 2-hour-long distance and how driving back it took him another 3.5 to 4 hours. Especially when Google, I mean, this is me now, but especially when Google says it should only take 3.5 to 4 hours total to get to Danby, Vermont from Liverpool, New York.
The scenic route, maybe?
Perhaps. But it's only 132 miles or 212 kilometers one way. Investigators realized that with this time frame, even though it didn't make sense for Michael's timeline of getting to a rest stop after 5 hours and making it home in another three, that if he did actually keep going to Vermont, his arrival would have lined up almost exactly with the anticipated time of death that the forensic examiner determined George and Catherine would kill at. So they bring him back and they ask him more questions. They asked about what he was wearing. No, you guys, not like that. Seriously, focus.
Khakis.
And Michael mentioned his work boots, which he had discarded. When asked why, Michael reported that he trashed them because they hurt his foot.
Just on that particular day.
Yeah.
He got an ouchie.
Further, he did tell them, and this makes me laugh a little, but he did say he discarded a gun recently. Although, they shouldn't think too much of it. He's a regular guy. He's just like a klutzy bit Butterfingers, and he accidentally dropped it in a river.
Like you do. I hate when I accidentally do that.
You know, it's just like, you're out, you're playing, you're with the fam, you and your wife are on like a date day, you just get out the gun for like fun, and oh my god, someone scares you, and it's like, ugh, there it goes.
It's a slip and fall. You hate to see it.
Sure doesn't float. So there's that. The kicker, though, is that they asked him a question that I thought was kind of odd. They said, Michael, our guy, have you ever had blackouts? Like, have you ever gotten so angry? Like, it's just, crazy. Like, you black out, you don't remember what you did.
Mikey.
And do you think that maybe you could have done that and gone to Vermont and killed the peacocks during a blackout? And Michael said, a super comforting. Yeah, I've thought of that.
You know, now that you mention it, by God, yes.
It has passed my mind.
I was trying to remember my dream last night.
Right? He did continue to say, though, once again, that he did not go to Vermont on the day of the killings.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And around this time, Michael also left an incredibly alarming note to Penny, essentially detailing what sounded to be a suicide letter. He left in it that he was afraid they were going to pin the murder of George and Catherine on him, and he did not kill her parents. Now, As a girl with anxiety, I can understand irrational fears and wanting to be assured that they're not true. However, as a girl with anxiety who is also in the psychology and criminal justice field, this doesn't seem irrational nor reassuring. It sounds sus as hell. And luckily, and kind of especially, once finding that Michael was not harmed and was, in fact, totally okay, it was extra weird.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like when you're in fourth grade and someone steals another kid's like pens, and before they even bring it up, they're like, I just want you to know if anything happens, it wasn't me.
They're like, okay, Timmy, what might have happened? Well, if anybody took your pens, I didn't do it.
Well, it's just, they're framing me.
Come on.
For something that didn't happen yet?
Brother, okay. Brother.
And now this is all suspicious as hell, right? Like, we know that this man's just guilty, guilty, guilty.
He had that long of a drive to think of an alibi and think of something came up else.
With, you know, I did think about it.
You know, I thought of that and dag nabbit, that wasn't me. But they're going to, honey. They're going to try. It's me, though. They're going to try to tell you shit, but you know me.
But come on.
You know it takes 8 hours to get there.
It takes 8 hours round trip to drive something 4 hours round trip within state.
You know that.
Come on. But without any direct link or anything at this point backing up their suspicions, the police had to continue investigating. And for many reasons, including their best chances to close this case with an arrest, they weren't able or willing to give a lot of this background information to the public yet. But between a few break-ins recently and the town gossip about potential family involvement in this murder, the town was in total fear. And in their exact words, they were angry, angry, angry.
Oh, you don't want people to be angry, angry, angry.
No, especially not in small towns. Danby, in nearby small town Vermont, was terrified. We all know of the true crime trope where a case shocks a town to its core and starts people locking their doors, raising eyebrows at neighbors, and generally terrifying small places that once felt safe. And this was no different. The town, in fact, was actually so disturbed they put in a petition requesting for more police surveillance and noted that they didn't want any excuses on budget cuts. It was also said around this time that the residents started carrying more weapons when checking out strange noises or finding themselves meeting someone who was new.
Mm-hmm.
Or that they thought like wasn't supposed to be there. So this was like happy-go-lucky teeny tiny town, and then suddenly your local like mama and peepaw are stabbed and they can't, the whole town gets so riled they write a petition. The town gets together and writes a petition.
All 1,200 people.
All of them. But more than that, small town residents did what they do best. They got nosy.
Yeah, they did.
They called the police and they were like, listen, this might not be relevant, but like, I think she was a Gemini or this happened or that happened. But mostly, they actually were incredibly helpful. They were like, I know every single car that drives down this road. There was a weird tan car around this time. Don't know if it helps. XOXO Gossip Girl, you know? And further, investigators questioned Michael's coworkers. They're like doing a little more research into him. And they reported,
he's weird as hell.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't say.
They had some interesting information on Michael. They were actually fascinated when he threw away his boots. Because despite the fact that he worked, again, inside at a car rental job in an airport where there's no need to have, like, work boots. I'm guessing, like, Timberland kind of work boots. Mm-hmm. He always had them. In fact, it was so comical. They were, like, the one pair of shoes he always wore. It didn't matter what outfit he had on, what the occasion, he had his work boots on. And every year, what like he'd replace them, but he'd wear them out. And it was like kind of a running joke that like he'd drag his feet on it. Like it'd be the middle of winter. You'd be getting a nor'easter and he's like, fine, I'll get some so I can shovel without my foot falling off. Like,
yeah.
So it was literally such a big deal that everybody was gossiping about it the one day that he came in wearing sneakers after he threw these out.
That's got to be a slow news day if everybody's like, did you see what he's wearing on his feet?
He's got some fucking sneakers on. Like,
God.
Like,
Yeah, that's some small town shit.
That is some small town shit. So right around the time of the murders, this was like literally jaw-dropping to them. And on top of that, police questioned Michael's niece, Patricia Gannon, I think, or Gannon. She told them in detail about a really weird conversation she had with Michael, where he reported going to Vermont on the day of the murders and blacking out. Not only did this contradict exactly what he said, but played right into what the police asked, which was a particularly odd thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked Penny, his wife, if they could search the couple's car. And I don't know if they had one or two cars, but she obliged. She was like, whatever, search it. Like, this is her parents that were murdered. Like, she wants this solved. And I also think it's worth mentioning, and this is like a little bit of a trigger warning here, they found one other little interesting tidbit on Michael Louise. This included him being essentially found guilty of the rape of a 4-year-old in her home in Rhode Island in 1966.
I'm sorry, what?
Yep. Now, whether there was an evidence issue or it was a plea bargain, Michael pled no contest to carnal knowledge and only served 6 fucking years.
Yeah, back then, carnal knowledge of a woman was like the actual language used for rape.
Of a 4-year-old.
And he got how long?
6 years. This was in her home.
That man should have never been. All right. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And how long ago was this?
He would have, well, at this point, it would have been about 20 years.
Okay, so 20 years, he probably shouldn't have been out, I think, probably. Yeah,
I would say.
Okay.
Especially for a minor that young in their own home.
A 4-year-old?
4-year-old. 4.
I mean, that is brutal.
Yeah. Yep, and somehow he was able to get 6 years out of that.
And
so,
he's now married.
It's unclear to me whether or not Penny knows about this.
Well, I hope she didn't have kids with him.
I hope she didn't have kids with him, and I hope she didn't know.
Yep.
I think. I can't tell what's worse.
I hope the niece that was with her was never alone with him.
Yeah, especially because he seems to confide in her. I think she said this was eerily similar to like a conversation they had about this case where he said he blacked out. And this is why I think the police asked him in that way in the interview room, where they were like, we pulled your history and we saw that you've used this verbiage before.
To admit to something that right. you've done. So maybe. Was it this? Yeah.
But I don't know, because it sounds like timeline wise, at least the conversation with his niece was after that interview. But again, it's a little unclear. It's a little dated. But not only did they find all of that, but they found out that the couple's car, or at least Michael's car, was a boxy tan sedan. Isn't that interesting?
You don't say.
Yeah. And not only the color of the strange car that the neighbors reported, but also like kind of entirely inappropriate to get giant sheets of particle board into.
I'll say.
Not the point, but interesting. In it, they found the smallest drop of blood on the driver's side floor mat. But because of DNA testing at the time, they were in such early stages at this point that testing it wouldn't have even kind of worked on a sample that small. But also, what they would have gotten from it wouldn't have been necessarily helpful. Again, it was like that type testing more than anything else.
Right.
So they did one of my favorite things that investigators can do. They hoped.
Yeah.
They collected this as evidence and they put it away in hopes that one day the case would be solved or the scientific technology would be able to make something of it to help solve it. But after that, this case kind of goes cold. And by kind of, I mean it goes fucking frigid fast. Despite all of the circumstantial evidence they had to connect Michael to this crime, there was nothing direct. Even the blood could have been a paper cut from either him or his wife. They had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing illegal about getting tired and taking the long way home or having a weird conversation with your niece. Who's to say that even if he did black out, this is where he went or what he did? And also, like, the only thing I think that could have gotten him on seriously at this point was lying to the police. But they all knew that they were hoping for something bigger than that. And I know they didn't want to risk losing a trial and him getting off forever. Because of course.
He already got away once.
Right. So this case sat and sat and sat. A year goes by, 2, 3, 5, 10, 20, 30 years.
These poor people were murdered in the house 30 years goes by.
Yep.
Their kids are grandparents themselves now.
Yeah.
Their grandkids didn't grow up with their grandparents.
Nope. And this keeps going until the year of our collective trauma, 2020.
Oh.
COVID disrupted our lives in so many, many ways. Many bad and genuinely traumatic, but some good, like the beginning of grocery order pickups and DMV appointments. Whether it was that the police...
I think the bad outweighs the good there, but I appreciate the silver lining.
Yeah, listen, you can't have a silver lining without a giant fucking dark cloud.
Uh-huh.
It's a small lining, but I'm taking what I can get.
Yeah, a lot of people learned actually that meeting could actually really be an email.
Exactly.
So we have that.
And a lot of people got to work from home. Sick. And there was a lot of sourdough starters that were made.
Quite a few. One more, Tiger King actually was something people watched because we just thought it was 2 weeks to stop the spread and we had to stay home.
Yeah.
So we're like, let's watch some bullshit TV to pass the time. And then it turned into, I don't know, 2 years. But anyway, yeah. I'm not bitter.
Sometimes I'm not going to lie. I'm not nostalgic for the horror and the trauma of it all. But like, I do kind of miss that initial 2 week period where everyone was like, time for my hobbies I never do because we just have to be home for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody kind of felt like a Disney princess in a cottage, you know,
very briefly.
Well, also with like crippling anxiety and fear of impending doom, but not the point.
But other than that,
so this is all going on. This is the world we're in.
Yes.
Right. Well, smack dab you right in the middle of trauma.
She's got to say the C word on the podcast. I asked her not to.
I couldn't help it. Okay. Whether it was that the police, much like us, had less to do and were bored, which is unlikely in my opinion.
Oh, I think they were very busy with all the domestics that started happening in mid-COVID.
Yeah. Or that the PDs were just going through old case evidence, or that they somehow methodically picked this out. The Peacock's evidence blood stain was finally able to be retested for DNA.
After 30 years.
Yep. 31, technically, at this point.
Jeez.
And the analysis came back that it was, in fact, a direct match to George Peacock. And I know what you're going to say. Abby, there's only ever so much of a percentage of a match it could be.
There's only so much of a percentage of a match it could be.
Thank you so much for saying that, because this was actually a 1 in quadrillion match to George Peacock.
I don't buy it.
They ain't that many people.
So that's pretty significant evidence against Michael, because it's found in the tan sedan.
Yep. That belonged to Michael. And so this is the first piece of evidence that now puts the blood of the victim directly in their main suspect's car. But time is a fickle bitch, you know? So while more of it meant more time for science to test the blood and get the DNA, it also meant less certainty with the witnesses and players involved.
A lot of them are probably deceased.
Yeah. By this time, the main detective that first held the case had passed. Many of the friends and community members that would have talked about this and known them directly had passed. And for the people that were around, memories get hazy. I mean, they're in the middle of COVID. They kind of had a lot going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so beyond that, the police are struggling to find people around that are still able to talk about it, that could remember it clearly. And they decide to sort of go back and try to get a hold of Penny again. So now in her 70s,
jeez,
she was able to say that she did remember the investigation, even if it was hazy, and that she would give a statement that she believed Michael to be in Vermont that day.
But this is about the murder of her parents.
Yes. I think that she, from what I can see, there's not a ton from her, But from what I understand, I don't think that she necessarily knew. I think she might have suspected. I think she might have put some like cognitive dissonance in there. But like, I think between her husband and her parents went out because the entire investigation, she did anything she could to help them.
Yeah.
So she's like, you know, I know back then I said I wasn't sure, but I'm pretty sure. So I'd give you a statement. And now, finally, armed with a statement, DNA evidence, and a shitload of circumstantial evidence, oh, and also a warrant, Michael Louise was finally arrested for the murders of George and Catherine Peacock.
And he's now in his 70s, I'm guessing?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
On October 13th, 2022, 33 years and a month to the day after the murders of George and Catherine, Michael Louise was arrested at 79 years old.
Good God.
Seemingly, he had just been doing his normal thing in New York, and the only other charge he had between then and now was that he had, funny enough, possession of a firearm, which is a charge because he was a felon and couldn't have them.
But I thought he threw it in the river. No.
Well, that was one of them, and that makes me wonder if he should have had two.
No, did he lie? I don't think he'd lie. Do you think he'd lie?
Well, I feel like lying is, it's pretty bad. That being said, so is the sexual assault of a 4-year-old in her own home. So I don't really know where he draws the line, but like I could see drawing the line at lying.
I hope so.
Fucking asshole. So naturally, of course, he's pled not guilty. And while we cannot say this case is officially closed, there is some amount of closure to this case with the arrest. Now, in 2025, Michael Louise would be in his early 80s. And despite initially being held pre-trial with a bail set to a very unaffordable $200,000, he's been transported to a healthcare facility due to his failing health. This presents an odd challenge, as he initially had to have 24/7 supervision from correctional staff, which did happen for a while. They were with him all day, every single day. Until, that is, the bill for the correctional officer wages almost met the bail amount that was set. So it got to about $200,000 of costs to the state just for the people watching him to be there. God. And that didn't include meals or mileage or the healthcare expenses for Michael, which, of course, are also all costs the state had to cover.
Jeez.
So at this point, he was granted an ankle monitor so that he was technically in like house arrest, even though he's in this healthcare facility. There, he needs constant help to stand, shower, or even pee. And a court date was initially set for, I believe, like August of 2024. But the last update I saw was in July of 2023, which states that there is now currently no set date for trial.
Are they just maybe hoping he passes away before they spend the money on a trial?
That's kind of my thought.
You'd think he would admit it, put it to bed, be done with it. Because he's still going to get to stay in the facility. It doesn't change anything for him.
Right.
It's not like they're going to take him from there and put him in prison, but like give the family the closure that they deserve.
Yeah.
Maybe speak to why. I mean, my God, you got away with it. He literally got to live his entire life without having to serve any time for it.
And I think what frustrates me with this is that like we still don't know why. Again, there was no evidence of this like fortune that he came into possession of. There's no evidence that he took a buck from their wallet. He just stabbed them to stab them. Like, I don't think he would have really benefited from that unless his direct plan was to do that, wait for Penny to get her part of inheritance and then divorce. Like, literally, that's all I can think of as a very indirect line for him to get a hold of some of this. And I don't know that they were still married, but everything that referred to her as a Ms., not a Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible they divorced. I would kind of assume so, given her cooperation with everything and his blaring obvious guilt.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point with the boards that he was supposedly going to get that mm-hmm. wouldn't have fit in his car. So that just tells me that that wasn't the reason for going. That it does seem like he went there because it's such a long drive.
Right.
Not 8 hours worth, but such a long drive that he would have gone there with the intent to do that. That it makes me not believe it was one of those situations where they're having a conversation, it becomes a heated discussion, words are exchanged, somebody pushes somebody, and like, I don't know, it gets out of hand and somebody gets pushed down the stairs and now he's trying to make it look like something else so he stabs him. I don't know. Like, there's different variations of that, but it doesn't seem like it's something that he showed up and didn't plan to do. This sounds like he went there with the intention to do that.
Right.
And so not finding out what that reason was and if it wasn't a financial motivation just seems like it's greedy if it's a financial motivation, obviously, but then what else could it be?
Yeah, and even...
Because they seem like good people.
Even the particle boards don't make sense. Like, literally in today, if it's $20 to $40 a board, I don't know. Personally, I don't think I'd drive 4 hours for $60 worth of Home Depot goods.
I'd spend that in gas. It doesn't really seem...
Right. It doesn't seem like it's worthwhile. Mm. And there's no other gain. Not only did the car thing not work out at all. Like, I don't think he could have put him in there to begin with. But, like... The economics don't make sense. The gain doesn't make sense. The motivation, it's not there. Like, literally the only thing I can think of is, I know I'm getting a divorce. Maybe I can get half of this share of the inheritance. And that's it. Because nothing was taken. Not even like jewelry or something he could pawn really quick.
It's almost like I wish they'd offer him some kind of deal of like, you only have to wear the ankle monitor, I don't know, at night, something ridiculous because you really can't go anywhere during the day, but like something to try to tease the motive out of him to just kind of make sense of it, to offer some kind of closure to the family or at least just some answer to the question of why. But at the same time, if they arrested him at 79 and this didn't even start going to court until he's in his early 80s, cognitively, he could be in it. Now, there are some extremely sharp 80, 90-year-olds.
Oh, for sure.
Amazing. Yeah. But there's also a lot of people that really start to struggle at that age. And so we don't know what his health is. If it's as bad as it sounds like, where he needs round-the-clock care, he might not even be cognitively well enough to speak to that. He might actually not know.
Right.
Well, and at that point, that's just a suffering older gentleman who doesn't know what he did in his life.
And I think the hard part for me is because this isn't technically closed. We don't have an official... conviction, right? Like, I'm sure there are still parts of this investigation that haven't been released. There are two kids that exist that aren't mentioned anywhere in any of this research. Mm-hmm. And I have plenty.
Only Penny.
Right. And that's obviously because of her connection to Michael. But mm-hmm. like, if they know why, they have not let any inkling out. The family hasn't said anything. There's no like press release I can see from any of the kids or Penny that are like, this is what happened to my parents and this is why. It's just been like silence, static silence from anyone in the family that I can see. Law enforcement trudging along, trying to investigate. And then this obvious pattern of like, oh, look, there's one suspicious person. Oh, look, he was there. Oh, look, everything matches up. Oh, okay. We finally have evidence. And we finally have someone willing to say that they think he did it. Here.
Maybe when he's dead.
Maybe. But obviously, it's not over till it's over. So we will give you guys an update when we know. But that, dear listener, is what I have for you on the murders of George and Kathy Peacock. While Michael may have lucked out with his in-laws, it seems that George and Catherine had the worst in-law luck of all. So what do you think? Do you think Michael is guilty? Will he live to see his day in court? And by then, will it matter? Let us know. What do you think?
Oh, he did it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but let us know. Also, let us know about that mother of the groom wearing white to the wedding. Gotta know what you think about that.
Here's a question. If she wore a blue and black dress to the wedding, would someone think it's white and gold?
Okay, but the dress... Okay, but we can't fight
about this again. It is literally confirmed black and blue, and then they came out with a special edition white. Okay, anyway,
I know, but when you and I looked at the same picture, you saw blue and black, and I could not understand how your glasses could not be the right prescription, that you can't see that it's white and gold.
I'm just worried about you. If you think that's white and gold, what color do you think I'm wearing right now?
And see, I'm so worried about you because...
Anyway, you guys, also let us know about that down below. Are you on my side? It's black and blue, right?
This is an Abby versus Allie conversation, and the right side is Allie's white and gold.
Let us know that too, I guess.
So we have a lot of inquiries for you here, so please let us know. If you liked what you heard today, we definitely think you should rate us 5 stars. We'd give you all of the nose boops and forehead kisses that you can muster. And we'd love for you to reach out to us. You can do that via email, or you can do that on our Instagram, which is all linked below in the link tree. We also think that you should tell a friend, tell a family member, help us spread that good word.
Tell a foe.
We love hanging out with you, and we love our little corner of the true crime world, and it wouldn't be the same without you. So we love you.
Love you.
And we will see you next time.
So if I do look at my clock, that was...
About time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.
It was like blue and black though.
They're so rude.